Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Megan Ortiz, publisher of VivirLatino.com, who takes a critical look at some immigration reform proposals being made, with concern about the punitive nature of the measures and the political motives in play. Rita Nakashima Brock of the Soul Repair Center at Bright Divinity School in Fort Worth, Texas, who explains why she believes a condition known as moral injury is likely one of the most important factors in the high rates of military suicides. And Martin Smith, writer and producer of The Untouchables, who talks about his frontline investigation into why the federal government has failed to prosecute any Wall Street or bank executives for the mortgage fraud that led to the 2008 financial crisis. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In his second inaugural address, President Barack Obama proclaimed, "We will respond to the threat of climate change, knowing the failure to do so would betray our children and future generations." Yet, several weeks into his second term, it's not clear how the president will seek to keep his pledge to fight for policies to address climate change, green energy, and green jobs. Key cabinet positions in energy and environmental protection remain vacant. The reasons behind the failure of the landmark Waxman-Markey cap-and-trade bill in Congress during Obama's first term is still hotly debated within the administration. Harvard social scientist Theda Skocpol blames big environmental groups like the Environmental Defense Fund for promoting a grand bargain with big utility companies like Duke Energy to organize a centrist coalition in support of measures to address climate change. In the end, the insider compromise strategy failed because it was too technocratic, failed to enlist grassroots activists, and didn't calculate the Tea Party faction's ability to make any compromise position impossible. Others blame poor legislative strategy and tepid support from the Obama White House for the climate bill's failure. Writing in Foreign Policy, the Harvard scholar declares, "The congressional equation can only change if the proponents of carbon limits stop trying to arrange insider bargains and instead put together a transparent proposal such as a carbon tax with revenues refunded directly to citizens with an annual dividend check." Climate activists, Skocpol says, also need a powerful political movement that can influence the outcome of elections in swing districts. The views of the Rio beaches from the high slopes of Vidigal are spectacular, but not found in any tourist book. Until recently, the favela or slum on the hill was run by drug gangs where avoiding violence was a daily challenge. Life has settled down since police took control of Vidigal, and property values have soared. According to the Guardian newspaper, rents have tripled since 2010, and big-time investors are moving in. Rumors abound that celebrities like Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie are planning to buy property there. The rapid gentrification of Rio's favelas follows a similar pattern seen in other major cities like New York, London, and Beijing. The World Cup and Olympic Games, which are coming to Rio in 2014 and 2016 respectively, are accelerating the process of skyrocketing rents. Overall, the average housing rent in Rio has risen over 160% in recent years. While gentrification proceeds, open sewers continue to run through the favela's streets, with little improvements being made to schools or public health clinics. Tuberculosis and dengue fever are rampant, with many residents living in crude shacks with irregular or no water supplies. While the majority of people in the favelas told The Guardian they were pleased about improved security and new social services, several also expressed unease that they may eventually be forcibly relocated or priced out of their homes. The Pentagon decision to open up combat roles to women could create rapid changes in the ranks long before official deadlines dictate. The Christian Science Monitor reports women could be serving in infantry units before the drawdown of U.S. military forces in Afghanistan. Special operations units, such as the Navy SEALs, could also see female recruits in the near future. Over the past 12 years, more than 280,000 American women have been deployed into war zones in both Iraq and Afghanistan, where 152 women were killed. The branches of the U.S. military now have until January 2016 to determine if there are jobs under the new rules that should remain off-limits to women. Top Pentagon brass say they hope opening up combat positions to women will reduce sexual violence against female soldiers, noting that half of the women deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan reported being sexually harassed during their service. General Martin Dempsey, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, acknowledged the inferior status of women in the military may have led to abuse. General Dempsey recently told reporters, "I think that disparity begins to establish a psychology that led to the hostile environment for women." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Liz Becker.
The nation's Latino voters played a decisive role in determining winners and losers in the 2012 presidential election. Hispanic citizens voted in large numbers, with 71% supporting Democratic incumbent President Barack Obama, while only 27% cast ballots for Republican candidate Mitt Romney. The 44% gap was larger than Mr. Obama's 36% margin of victory over GOP candidate John McCain in 2008. Today, Latinos are the fastest-growing population in the U.S., while white voters, the most important constituency for the GOP, is trending toward minority status. These profound changes in the nation's demographics clearly indicate that the future of the Republican Party looks bleak unless they repair their long-running negative relationship with the Latino community. This may explain why some sectors of the Republican Party are now suddenly embracing immigration reform proposals made by President Obama that they quite recently strongly opposed. A bipartisan group of 8 senators came together on January 28th to announce their blueprint for immigration reform legislation that includes a chance for the estimated 11 million undocumented immigrants already in the U.S. to earn citizenship. But the framework also calls for new, tougher border security measures, including the use of aerial drones, and requires undocumented U.S. residents to undergo criminal background checks, pay fines, and back taxes. Your reporter spoke with Megan Ortiz, publisher of VivirLatino.com. Here she takes a critical look at some of the immigration reform proposals being made, with concern about the punitive nature of the measures and the political motives in play.
I think the obvious strength is the need for a pathway to citizenship, and I think that's something that, you know, the 11 million plus, and I think we need to acknowledge that that's probably an undercount, 11 million plus undocumented want. So I think that's definitely a positive, and I think that's what lots of organizations and individuals have been really rallying behind. But just the idea of a pathway to citizenship is enough. How do we get that pathway? And I think that's where we get into a little bit more of the complicated nuances. So I think, you know, for example, again, the idea of border enforcement coming first, we're at record spending levels right now on border security. You know, the amount of money being spent by the federal government on border enforcement surpasses all the other federal law enforcement initiatives in the country. You know, we have more quote-unquote boots on the ground. Obama has record deportation numbers. So I don't know what more border enforcement or security would look like, and frankly, that idea frightens me. So I think that's a big concern. Just also the idea of, you know, programs like employment verification, like E-Verify, is really problematic. You know, these sorts of programs and technical tools that are supposed to check whether somebody is legally able to work in the United States really have proven flawed. And that's not something that would just affect undocumented workers or workers who are legalized. That it already has proven to impact United States citizens, you know, with Social Security numbers being mismatched and glitches in the system. So we're talking about potentially hundreds of thousands of people whose employment could be affected if this program were to go national. You know, and there's a lot of concern in the Senate proposal about this temporary residency status that would have to happen before you're an actual green card holder. I'm concerned about this creation of a purgatory status where undocumented immigrants, you know, would be able to work but they wouldn't be quite legalized either. And during that time period, they wouldn't have access to services, any sort of federal services that they need. And this is something that we're already seeing happening with the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, DACA, which has benefited a good number of quote-unquote Dream Act students. But we're also seeing some controversy as to can those students access health care. It's a temporary two-year period. What happens after that two-year period? They have to reapply again. I mean, so there's lots of complicated nuances to what this path to citizenship means. But there's also a creation of a hierarchy, which is really concerning. You know, we hear lots of talk about promoting the quote-unquote STEM immigrants, you know, science, technology, engineering, math, you know, the entrepreneurs, the technocrats, et cetera. But we're not hearing a conversation about who makes up the majority of undocumented immigrants in the United States, you know, domestic workers, day laborers, you know, street vendors, who really provide a huge, huge economic benefit to the United States and who have been here for many, many years, who have family, who have families here and pay more into the United States economic system than they're able to take out.
What is the role, in your view, of grassroots organizations in the near term about how comprehensive immigration reform is hammered out in Washington, given the fact that in the past, going back to 2006, there were, you know, more than a million people on the streets demonstrating in very high visibility and dramatic protests around the country trying to set the agenda for immigration reform back then? Are these groups liable to emerge now that there is something in the works in Washington which, you know, could be drafted into law?
You know, I think we've seen a lot of these groups have come out already in favor of the conversation moving forward. I know there are marches and rallies planned now for the spring. But I think what organizations and whether they be advocacy or activist organizations or organizations run by undocumented immigrants themselves, I think the role that they play really has to be to move the starting point of negotiation. Comprehensive immigration reform through more enforcement doesn't make a lot of sense, since that's what we've had plenty of over the last 4 years. So I think the role of organizations is just going to be to push back against that rhetoric and push back against that being implemented further into policy. And a lot of that stuff is stuff that happens behind the scenes. And I think we kind of need to lift that veil a little bit as well as to who's talking to who behind the scenes. It hurts the Latino community, the immigrant community, and activists when there's lots of backdoor negotiating happening. And I think we really need to see a lot more grassroots input into what a progressive, comprehensive immigration framework would look like.
That was Megan Ortiz, publisher of VivirLatino.com. For more perspectives and analysis on the immigration reform debate, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. There's a growing body of knowledge exploring the issue of moral injury among veterans returning from America's wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. The condition results from a conflict between an individual's view of one's moral self and one's behavior in war. Moral injury can occur along with PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, but the two conditions have different origins. In recent years, the nation has witnessed a steep rise in the number of military veterans committing suicide. Last year, more active duty U.S. soldiers killed themselves than died in combat. In a recent report, the Department of Veterans Affairs found that the number of suicides among veterans reached 22 a day in 2010, the most recent year available. That was a 22% increase from 2007, when the daily number of veterans taking their own lives was 18. Rita Nakashima Brock, the founding co-director of the Soul Repair Center at Bright Divinity School in Fort Worth, Texas, and previous director of the fellowship program at the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study at Harvard University, maintains that moral injury is likely one of the most important factors in military suicide rates. She believes that society needs to examine the link between military suicides and the moral impact of military training and its implementation in combat where soldiers kill. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Nakashima Brock, who from 2001 to 2002 was a fellow at the Harvard Divinity School Center for Values in Public Life. He or she explains the difference between moral injury and PTSD, the ways in which therapists and clergy are working to help veterans deal with the condition, and the responsibility of society at large to support those returning soldiers suffering with this psychological injury.
Moral injury is the impact on a person's moral conscience and sense of being a moral self in relation to war service. And it can come from actually having done something that you might think is wrong, but it can also just come from doing your duty in war and then returning home and beginning to think about the moral implications of war service. It's been confused with PTSD because it often can occur at the same time. They overlap. But PTSD is indication of damage to your limbic brain, your emotional perceiving brain system that processes experience and calms down fear. And when that's injured, there's a clear symptom profile for PTSD because you're not able to calm down fear and that part of your brain isn't functioning very well. Moral injury is different. It's actually the healthy function of your thinking executive brain where you do moral reasoning and collect memories and think about them and reflect on them in moral terms. So a person who's a healthy moral person can experience some kind of extreme condition and begin to lose their bearings in terms of being able to figure out what's right and wrong. And they can't do that if their executive brain isn't functioning. I think moral injury is actually quite common in anyone who served in war. I just think we haven't had a way to talk about it, but you see it in war literature. It's in parts of the Bible. It's in war poetry. It's that kind of anguish that you hear in the voice of people who've returned from war. The VA, the Veterans Affairs clinicians, actually have suggested recently that it might be a greater factor in veteran suicide rates than PTSD, and I think that's actually right. It's really a weird thing we do. We take as normal people who have been taught that killing is criminal activity and then train them because it's important for them to learn how to kill. But there's also a moral code in the military. It's not like the training is wanton violence. There are rules of engagement. You aren't supposed to kill civilians and all sorts of things like that. But in the context of war, a lot of that stuff can go haywire in emergency situations. And in a counterinsurgency operation, you're shooting at civilians. There aren't any soldiers in uniforms. And so it can become morally very confusing and anguishing to even be in a war like that.
Rita Nakashima Brock, does the VA recognize moral injury as a specific diagnosis?
No, not that I know of. I know that they've been trying to figure out how to collect data to make it something they could treat. But I think, in fact, it's the kind of thing that you don't get over. I think you learn how to cope with it and live with it and rebuild a civilian identity. It's like you're living in two moral universes. You're living in the civilian moral universe, and then you're living under the military moral codes. And then you leave the military and you come back into civilian life, and those are clashing codes. They don't align well. And so you have to figure out how you're going to be a decent person in civilian society again. But the VA did actually publish an essay. A group of VA clinicians at the end of 2009 published, I think, the first scholarly clinical paper on moral injury in which they suggested it was different from PTSD and that it was a factor in the difficulty that veterans were having reassimilating into civilian society. And they even suggested an 8-step protocol for clinicians to help veterans work through moral injury.
Can you summarize what those steps are?
They have to do with needing a community of support to help you recover, to give you a chance to talk about what happened without judging you, to talk about your moral questions, your faith questions, like if you don't believe in God anymore, what happened to you, and to help you process those, not to give you pat answers, but to listen deeply and kind of walk with you in a sort of friendship way of struggling through those questions as faithful companions, and a chance to do good in the world, a place where you could make amends in some way for something that is all out of kilter in your life, that you feel like if you destroyed so much that you could actually help construct something positive. And those are all things I think religious communities understand. So we've made our mission at the Soul Repair Center training communities, not just religious communities, but veterans groups, employers, and others, and how you do this walking with someone through the process of recovery from moral injury. We don't want to stigmatize moral injury as some kind of disorder or problem. I think it's actually a fairly normal response to life and death conditions that are extreme and anguishing and where a moral choice isn't clear. It's our social responsibility, our responsibility as a society, to take this on because we've asked or sent these people to fight in wars on our behalf, whether we support the war or not. That's what they've done. And so I think we all have a responsibility to support the process of their returning to us.
That was Rita Nakashima Brock, the founding co-director of the Soul Repair Center at Bright Divinity School in Fort Worth, Texas. Her latest book is titled Soul Repair, Recovering from Moral Injury After War, co-authored with Gabriella Latini. Find more information on moral injury on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The U.S. Justice Department announced on February 5th that the government was proceeding with a lawsuit against Standard & Poor's, charging that the ratings agency, knowingly and with intent to defraud, executed a scheme to defraud investors. Standard & Poor's, along with other ratings agencies, stand accused of issuing their highest AAA ratings for toxic securities made up of subprime bundled residential mortgages. When the housing market crashed, the securities lost their value, triggering major losses to some of the largest banks and the global financial meltdown. But the lawsuit launched against Standard & Poor's is a rare action undertaken by the federal government to hold Wall Street firms and big banks accountable for the global financial crisis that unfolded in 2008. A new PBS Frontline investigation titled The Untouchables asked why the U.S. Department of Justice has failed thus far to act on credible evidence that Wall Street knowingly packaged and sold toxic mortgage loans to investors, loans that resulted in the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression. Despite strong evidence of fraud uncovered by state governments like New York and presented by eyewitnesses interviewed in The Untouchables, the federal government has failed to prosecute any top bank or Wall Street executives whose decisions led to record unemployment, millions of home foreclosures, and personal bankruptcies. Your reporter spoke with Martin Smith, Frontline correspondent and writer and producer of The Untouchables, who talks about his investigation and why he believes those responsible for the financial crisis have escaped criminal prosecution.
First of all, I went in having read quite a bit about what had happened. It was clear that demand was generated by Wall Street for more and more mortgages, as you say, to securitize and get out the door and sell to investors, whether they be pension funds or banks in Germany or anywhere in the world. So the money was being collected in by Wall Street for the sales of these mortgage-backed securities, and then that money would go back down the chain to the originators. And we know that the Justice Department has, in fact, the FBI has arrested and prosecuted a number of mortgage originators. But what's missing in all of that is that those people may get busted, but what about the people that were on Wall Street? And so we wanted to go to find the people who were at the center of this whole chain, and those people work in a part of the business that I wasn't that familiar with. I'd heard of rating agencies. That's sort of a different part of this, and we've heard a lot about that, but we hadn't heard so much about these due diligence folks that were called in by the banks. And so we talked to those people who were getting instructions from the bank to take a look at the loans, and what we found from them, they told us that they got instructions to loosen the standards, to let the bad loans come on through, to rank them as good when they knew they were bad or when they knew they were fraudulent. So those people reported the loans being in better shape than they were to the portfolio managers at the banks, and the banks went ahead knowing this, packaged them, and sold them to investors, misrepresenting the quality of the loans. And that is fraud, and that is being litigated now. Banks are suing. various different investor groups, insurance companies, are suing the banks, but the Justice Department says they can't make a case. And that was really, we wanted to hold accountable the Justice Department for, if you will, failing to hold the banks accountable.
What about the larger picture here in terms of our political system and the money flowing from Wall Street to politicians, and how people in their minds, whether you know you can trace that exactly and connect the dots specifically? I think a lot of people in this country believe the money flowing to politicians is one of the major factors why there has not been any prosecutions here. And I wonder how you respond to that notion.
Banks are deemed too vital to the health of the rest of us. And indeed, we've seen the results when the credit markets freeze up. It does have consequences for us all. But yet, since the crisis of 2008, the banks were famously bailed out and have grown larger. All of them, I think, except for Citigroup, are larger than they were. So given their size, it doesn't take a genius to realize what that means in terms of Washington, in terms of the amount of money they have available, in terms of the amount of power the lobby has to affect outcomes on Capitol Hill. We've seen Dodd-Frank legislation moving extremely slowly from passage and into real regulation. At every step of the way, the process is slowed by the lobbyists who are looking out for their own self-interest. You know, one thing, when you look across the various financial sectors in the United States and you look at the profit margins in finance and compare them to, say, automobiles and whatnot, banks like J.P. Morgan Chase have profit margins that are in the 25 to 30% range, gross profit margins before taxes. And when you look at automobiles, it's like 5%, pharmaceuticals, it's around that same thing. The only sector that I know that comes close to cigarettes at 23%. So these are tremendously profitable engines, and they do wield tremendous power as a result.
That was Martin Smith, frontline correspondent and writer and producer of The Untouchables. Visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org, where you can find a link to watch The Untouchables and related articles. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Liz Becker, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.